I was studying parts of the Haggadah. The Halach Ma'anya is very interesting for a number of reasons. What is the most striking thing about Halach Ma'anya? Translated, this is the bread of affliction. Interesting to note, we've mentioned this many times, that the matzah has a signification. It has ideas associated with it. And interestingly enough, it is the bread which expresses geula, which expresses redemption. Yet here we're saying it's the bread of oni. Oni could be translated affliction, or it could be translated aniyim, poor people. It's the bread of the poor people that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Now that's not in line with what we say later on. Later on, when we have the three things, which are very, very important, that Rabbi Gamliel says, whoever does not say these three things did not fulfill his obligation. In the statement that Rabbi Gamliel said, that whoever did not say these three things on Pesach did not fulfill his obligation. And they are Pesach, Matzah, Umara. Now there's two ways of understanding this. The question is, which obligation are we talking about? Are we talking about the obligation of the Pesach, the Matzah, and the Maror? Now in the commentary I have over here, that's one way of interpreting it. He says that even though a person ate these foods, did not fulfill his obligation, except through enunciation. The other way of understanding it is that it's a reference to the mitzvah of Sipur, of telling the story. The question is whether the enunciation of these three things, and he doesn't just mean just saying the words, obviously, because each paragraph now, he means the elucidation of the idea of the mitzvah. If you didn't do that, then you did not fulfill your obligation. Either referring to the obligation of the mitzvah of Sipur, or the obligation of the mitzvah of these three, each one. Which would be more difficult to comprehend? Which explanation is more difficult to comprehend?
The eating.
Because what in effect would be difficult about that? Why would that be difficult? In general, the mitzvah, if a person performs the mitzvah, there's a question as to whether the person has to have intent. Interestingly enough, there's a lenient position that maintains that even if he just ate it without any intention. He just ate matzah that night without any intention for the mitzvah. That's the question. There's an argument. Can you fulfill a mitzvah without intent if you did the action that the mitzvah would require? Let's say, for example, it happens to be Rosh Hashanah and someone picks up a shofar and starts blowing shofar, but he wasn't intending to do the mitzvah. And in the course of doing it, he's made the appropriate sounds. Or on the night of Pesach, if the person was sitting around and he saw the moon, that looks good, some matzah. And he takes matzah and he eats the matzah. But he wasn't thinking, I'm doing this because I want to do the mitzvah. Did the person fulfill the mitzvah? That's a halachic argument. Okay, we're not talking over here about that issue. Obviously, if the person says, the one who says that if you didn't say these three things, which means, if you didn't enunciate the purpose of the mitzvah, or the concept of the mitzvah. If you didn't enunciate the signification of these three things, he's saying you didn't fulfill the mitzvah. Of what? Of eating. So that if that's very, very important. So certainly if you did not have, well, it's interesting. What would that person's position be on the question if you didn't have intention for the mitzvah? It would seem obviously it's no good. He's going beyond that, correct? However, it's possible that he could still say that you fulfill it without intention. I'll tell you how. That is, the person said these said about the matzah, so he knows the idea of matzah. The question is, when he's actually eating the matzah, does he have to be cognizant at the time? That is, he knows the idea of matzah, and then he got distracted, and then he ate some matzah without thinking I'm doing it for the sake. But he knows the signification of matzah. Or are we saying that at the moment of the eating of the matzah is when he has to have this idea in mind? So we have two questions now. First of all, why is this the case? This is not the case in the other mitzvos. In general, there's no such requirement that when you perform a mitzvah, that you have to, before you do it, you have to consider the idea. For example, going into the sukkah on Sukkot. So one goes and does the mitzvah. You don't have to stop and think what the reason is, because I caused the Jews to be housed in Sukkot when I took them out of Egypt, and so on. Of course, it's better to do so. You should know what you're doing. But nobody would say that you weren't yotzei the mitzvah. Let's assume, just to make it simple, that he has intention. He said, well, nobody's going into the sukkah just to go into the sukkah. I mean, that's clearly that's a mitzvah, which by its very nature, a person is doing it only for the mitzvah. Nobody goes into a sukkah. There's no such thing in the real world as a sukkah. It's purely a halachic construct. Right? The same is true with the lulav. People do the mitzvah. If they're interested, they'll ask. And if they're not, they won't ask, but they did the mitzvah. And so on and so forth. Thus, what's the reason for the exception? This is an exception to the rule. That's my first question. My second question is, what is the intention? Is the intention that you just have to study this, and if you said this, then you're okay, and you fulfill the mitzvah subsequently when you eat it? Even if at the time you ate it, you weren't thinking about this? Or no, what he means is that make sure that before you eat it, you review these ideas. You'll also notice that this seems to be a different explanation of the matzah. It's not saying what we said before, that this is the bread of affliction or it's the poor person's bread. In the Halach Ma'anya, we designated matzah as being the bread of affliction which our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. That is not talking about the time of the Exodus. Here, when we say Pesach Shehoyu Avaseinu Ochlin Bizman Shebeis HaMikdash Kayam, we then proceed and say, well, let's go to the matzah. We do say the Pesach. Obviously, that interpretation, there's a problem with the interpretation that says you're not yotzei the mitzvah of the matzah. There's a problem with that. You could see right away. What's the problem? The problem with that is, if you're telling me that you're lacking in sipur, then everything is fine. Pesach, matzah, maror. If you're telling me you're lacking in the performance of the mitzvah, then what do I have Pesach for? We're not doing the mitzvah of Pesach. Yeah. As we see, that our manishtana, our four questions, are not the way, there weren't always four questions. There would have been a question pertaining to the Pesach. There's nothing magical about the number four. There would have been a question pertaining to the Karban, to the Pesach. And we don't have that today, that question, because it's not true, since we don't have the Karban Pesach. Now, it seems to me that the inclusion of the paragraph about the Pesach does lend weight to the one who says it's talking about the Sipur, because that's part of the Sipur. Of course, you can, if you want, you can say, well, why? Since we don't do it now, why is it lacking in the Sipur if I don't mention the Pesach? You could ask the same kind of question, but it's not the same. Because that's, you could say, well, look, even though we don't do the mitzvah, but you should be cognizant of the ideas. That's how I would defend that position. All right, so it's true we don't do the Passover sacrifice, but understanding the sacrifice is part of the mitzvah of Sipur. Fine. But in terms of, if you're going to talk specifically about the eatings, then why mention that the Pesach? We don't eat the Pesach now. So that should be eliminated, and we should just focus on the matzah tomorrow. Okay? Let's just deal with the side that says eating. Aside from the question I just asked, okay? Perhaps he would say that that was brought in because it is a mitzvah to eat the Pesach, even though we don't have it today, and it does contain ideas. That is to say that I'm sure he would say, I don't think that he says it's only pertaining to the eating. I'm sure he would agree that if you didn't mention these things, you're lacking in Sefer. But additionally, he's saying, additionally, you're lacking in the eating mitzvah. So that would be a resolution. That is, the other side says it's exclusively because of the Sefer, not because of eating. He says it's both. But let's ask ourselves this question. It's an exception to the rule of mitzvos. In the realm of mitzvos, we don't demand that the person be cognizant of the reason for the mitzvahs. People put on tefillin every day. They don't know the reason necessarily. People put on a mezuzah. They don't know the reason necessarily. So we generally separate, we differentiate between the activity of the mitzvah, the action of the mitzvah, to do the mitzvah. In Hebrew we call it the ma'isa mitzvah, as opposed, and the purpose or the reason for the mitzvah. We differentiate between the two. And we say that you fulfilled your obligation if you performed the mitzvah properly. If a person lights candles on Friday night for the Shabbos, even if they don't know the reason for it, they fulfill the mitzvah. And so on and so forth. So why is it over here that if you ate the matzah because you want to do the mitzvah, but you don't know the idea of the matzah, you weren't fulfilling the mitzvah? Why is this? This would be an exception to the rule. Here, awareness of the reason is part of the doing of the mitzvah. Another question in connection with this would be, the first portion of the Haggadah, interestingly enough, that is, from the four questions, the first section, as we've said many times, deals with the study of the laws, of the mitzvos of the night. That part that starts from Avodim Hayinu, we were slaves, is, each one of them goes into a different aspect of the mitzvos of the night. We were slaves is establishing the obligating factor, the event in history which creates the obligation to engage in the mitzvah of Sipur. And then the subsequent paragraphs illustrate the idea that it doesn't matter how much you've learned, how much you know, that each person must engage in the study of the subject matter on this night, and the more you get involved in it, the more praiseworthy. You have that discussion, and so on. Then you have the, after a few paragraphs pertaining to that area, you have the issue of the mitzvah to teach it to your children. Teach it to your children, and then that too, it's a study of how to teach your children. So, in effect, before we actually get around to the basic mitzvah of the night, which is Sipur, first we study the rules pertaining to the Sipur. That also is extremely unusual. When do we have that? What holiday do you have that? We get the night of Sukkot, we go into the Sukkah. We don't start studying the laws. Obviously, you should know them. I mean, if you have a question, whatever. But that's not part of the protocol. That's not done in a formal, organized way. Here, we study first the laws of the night. Then we get into the performance. Yeah, the other question, getting back again to the dual signification of the matzah, which is the second paragraph of the foods. So we point to the matzah. Matzah zu. That's also interesting. We point to the matzah. Let me ask a question. I mean, it sounds like a silly question. But you're allowed to ask. Pesach is the time to ask questions. Why do you have to point to it? This is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch. When the person says matzah zu, he's required to lift the prusa. The prusa is the broken piece. The piece has been broken already, which is called lechem oni, which is called the bread of affliction, and to show that to those who are gathered around. Well, he says, "Kedei lechabe b'aleim es ha-mitzvah," in order to render the mitzvah more beloved. Again, I ask the question, but why? We know what you're talking about. Anybody, I'm sure everybody there knows. If they don't know Hebrew, you say it in English. That's very, very important. that especially on the night of Pesach, the Haggadah should be said in English unless you know the Hebrew. It should be translated or said in English. I have a reason for it. It's not just a good idea. It's more specific to the Haggadah. Then in other cases, although it's true in general, to the best of our ability, we should know what's being said. Here, however, I would say it's different, that if you hear the Megillah in Hebrew, and even if you don't know what's being said, but you know they're reciting the Megillah, you just don't understand the Hebrew, which is the case for many, many Jews that go to the shul, you fulfill the obligation, because you listen and you know it's the Megillah, even if you don't understand the word. I would venture to say that not so by the Haggadah. That's true of reading, I mean, most kids, even in prayer, even in Tefillah. In Tefillah, with the exception of the first paragraph, God of our fathers, that you must know what you're saying. From that point on, obviously you should know what you're saying, but if you did not, if you retain the intention that this is a prayer to Hashem, and you recite the words in Hebrew, it counts. I would venture to say that not so by the Haggadah. Now let's continue with the paragraph. It's done with a question. There's a lot of rhetorical. We ask a question, and we're going to provide the answer. We don't just go straight. We don't go straight to the declaration. We could have simply said, this matzah that we eat is because there was not enough time for the dough of our forefathers to rise. We don't. We start off with a question, and then we give the answer. Because why do we eat it? Because there was not enough time for the dough of our fathers to rise until the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, revealed Himself to them and redeemed them. It says that. Then it cites the Pasuk. It cites the verse from the Torah which backs up this point. Shanemar, as it says, Vayofu as a batek, they baked the dough that they removed from Egypt, cakes of matzah, because it did not leaven, because they were exiled, they were driven out from Egypt, and they could not tarry, and also tzedah, also provisions they had not made for themselves. We'll have to explain why we have to know about the fact that they didn't do provisions. But at any event, therefore, the matzah is the bread of redemption, so to speak. It's the, we'll use the word symbol, the symbol, the signification of the redemption. Yet, at the same time, we're saying it's the bread of affliction, which seems to be two different ideas. So how could it be both? It seems that the night, of course, has a unique character. And it's not just the telling of a story. The story has a certain objective. It has to lead to a certain conclusion. And, of course, the conclusion is the relationship of the Jewish people to Hashem and the foundation, so to speak. This is the foundation of everything. The Torah, the command, the whole way of life, the whole Jewish way of life. So that's why it's the night of the transmission. That's why you have children present. That's why it's the teaching. It's, you see, there's many aspects to the mitzvah, that it's not something which is done in isolation. Of course, if a person is completely alone, he engages in the activity of the sipur, and he even does so in the manner of question and answer. But here's a situation where one should definitely, if possible, not be alone. A person should join together with others for the Seder. That's very important. Different than, for example, on Shabbos or Yom Tov. Let's say a person on Shabbos does not like to get together with people, prefers to be alone. Is that lacking, or should you get together and have a meal with others on Shabbos? Yeah, on Shabbos, I would say that it's up to you. Generally speaking, whenever there's some kind of an occasion, a festive occasion, you'd like to share it with others. But that depends, and not you know. Sometimes you certain specific people. Some people just don't want to be alone, and they always prefer to be with other people on Shabbos. But if a person prefers to be alone, that's not lacking in the mitzvah. That's his own. To the contrary, for some people, it's not pleasurable to have to be with others socially. They're not. They like to be alone.
That's an
ek Shabbat. That's on ek Shabbat. That's on ek. So the person should be free. Here I would say it's different because the very essence of the experience is to engage in a dialogue. This is the, it reflects, in my opinion, the specific Jewish approach to learning, which we discussed by the Kruvim. If you remember, that the Kruvim reflect an idea that the whole essence of Judaism has to do with being involved in study, but not just any kind of study, there's a specific method. There are many, many ideas attached to the concept of that he's no save and no same. That's what the term Baal Turim says. The give and take. There's a dialogue. There's something which is unique and special to the phenomenon of a dialogue. Not to say that there's also, of course, thought, that a person gets completely involved by himself in thought. That is true. But eventually, the thought itself is not the final step. Let's put it that way. We recognize the importance of thought, isolation. A person has to be capable of going off into an isolation booth, so to speak, and just thinking. You can't do all of your learning discussing it up and back, up and back, up and back, I would say, because there's got to be a certain point where you completely focus on the idea and thinking, and you can't be thinking when you're talking. That's why, very often in the shiur, there's points where we all stop. We get stuck on a question, okay, let's think. And everybody's quiet and everybody's thinking. But then after that, Laurie, let's talk it out. Let's talk it out, what you come up with. You got to talk it out and put it together. And that's the idea of Chavrusa. You got to present your ideas and discuss them and have the questions and give the answers and so on and so forth. That's the classical form of give and take. That's why the mitzvahs of this night are not perfunctory. They're not rituals. Unfortunately, in most cases, it's not done properly. Now, I'm saying in general, the mitzvahs of the Torah are not perfunctory. That's true. Are not rituals, but the nature of the relationship between the doing of the act of the mitzvah, the activity, and the concepts, the ideas, the philosophy, are more pronounced on this night. Give, because that's the whole objective of this night. The whole objective of this night is to be involved in the foundations of Judaism, to experience the geula, and that's a mental thing. If you don't have the ideas of the night, then what are you involved in? You're not involved in anything. You're just going through rituals. Here, it's the establishment of the foundations of the system itself. Once the system is established, and once it's founded, it starts, and then there's different activities you have to do, and you do your best. So then we have this differentiation between the act of the mitzvah and the reason behind it, because you don't always know the reason. You may not have learned the reason, but you got to do the mitzvah anyways. But that's true. There's a certain process that you go through, however, in determining that you want to be part of the system. Let's assume someone is searching for the true religion. So after a certain amount of time of searching, of studying, of questioning, and asking for explanations, so then the person makes a decision. Now, once they make the decision, so they accept upon themselves the system. That doesn't mean that they know. They don't know the reason for everything at that point in time. When a person first converts, have they studied every myth? They never have a convert. We don't demand that a person has studied every one of the 613 commandments and knows the reason for everything. No, it's not the case. Now you're living a Jewish life. Our part of a Jewish life is to study, to grow, there's growth. So that makes sense. We can't demand the different mitzvahs coming up at different points in time. We can't demand that a person has to know the reasons. No, but as a result, since you're doing them and you're studying, you'll eventually you'll get the full benefit from them. But here we're talking about foundational. When it's talking about the foundation, that's something that you have to be cognizant. It doesn't make any sense that you're engaged in a foundational and you don't know what you're doing. That doesn't make any sense at all. This is a foundational phenomenon. So that on this night, the whole idea of the night is to be cognizant of the significance of Yetzias Mitzrayim, what the significance is, and how it relates to us, as we say that it's not only our forefathers that we were redeemed, to be cognizant of what you're doing and to achieve the significance, the meaning of the night. That's the objective of the night. That's why everything on this night is done with intention and with thought. Even the very mitzvahs of the night, we study the mitzvahs of the night. You should know what you're doing. Which is not the case by the other holidays. It has a different... being cognizant of the philosophical significance of what you're doing is important all the time, but it has a different significance on the other holidays than on this one. The Seder is very, very big. Even though, as I'm saying, it's hard for me to understand what real benefit there is. I don't mean... Look, practically speaking, if people get together and there's a certain... they're having a Seder, whatever it is, on any level, is it... it's better than nothing, I have, in the sense that they're showing some respect or showing some recognition for Jewish tradition. But in terms of what the Seder really is, and that is that it's a reaffirmation of the foundations of Judaism, and the end result is that we give praise to Hashem, Hallel, to view it as though we were redeemed, to achieve the redemption. And the redemption has to do with the fact that we are God's people, which means that we live according to the Torah, to God's Torah. If a person does not have those ideas, then he hasn't fulfilled anything. There's no real fulfillment. That's why I'm saying, for this reason, I'm saying that if a person just recites Daggad and doesn't know the Hebrew, doesn't know what he's saying, nothing has been achieved. What's been achieved? There's no fulfillment of a mitzvah here, because Haggadah is to be involved in the ideas. That's the whole essence of it. To the extent that the very activities that we're performing, the very mitzvos, are meant to reinforce all the ideas. Now we can understand the reason for the eating of the matzah. That is, we recite the idea that's to be associated. So what do you gain from the actual eating? The eating is an activity which gives it a certain reality. The fact that we're eating this food, that means to say that as a result of this event, as a whole system was established, and there's mitzvos, there's commandments, and they've been transmitted through the generations down to our day, these are the thoughts. And when we actually eat it, it has a certain impact upon the soul. The very act of eating has an impact upon the soul, provided that it's associated with these ideas. That's why he's saying, before you eat it, you better stop and think. What are you accomplishing? You're just eating something. You're just doing a ritualistic performance and you have no idea what you're doing. What's the point? What have you accomplished with the eating? That is not the case, for example, by other mitzvahs, because you're doing a mitzvah. You know, this is a commandment. I'm fulfilling one of God's commandments. And it's a higher level to know the reason behind it, but I'm keeping the system. I'm keeping the system by doing it. So that's the idea. That even if you didn't know the mitzvah, the reason for it, you kept the system. You did a good thing. But here we're establishing the foundations. I'm committing myself to the system. So these mitzvahs are different. And that's, you could see it even more clearly with the maror. There's a difference between the maror and the matzah. Even though they're the basic idea to eat the food, thus giving the ideas a certain reality by reenacting, or by the very fact that I'm eating this food, that means it's real for me, otherwise I wouldn't be eating it. It just seems to me that the matzah is more of an abstraction. The matzah itself doesn't have that kind of an impact upon you. It's like a cracker. It's not... in terms of the taste, the eating experience per se, it doesn't have that kind of an effect upon you. It's more in the abstract. The matzah from an eating standpoint, from a culinary standpoint, I think is pretty neutral. Pesach is, for some people, it's difficult to go without bread for the 7 days. People get a little antsy about it. It's very, very interesting. You see the inside of the Torah, that it picked something to give it the character. As we've said, the Rambam explains, it can't just be one day. That's Chag HaMatzos. The whole character of the Chag is influenced by the matzah factor. And you cannot have that without the deprivation of the chametz. Chametz refutes matzah. If you could have chametz, then there's no matzah. The whole idea of the matzah means that it's exclusive. It's exclusive. And that's why the punishment for the eating of chametz is so severe, because by doing so you're negating the theme of matzah. The theme of matzah, of course, is fundamental ideas about the relationship between God and the world. And the world. Fundamentals of Judaism are contained on this holiday. We're going back to the fundamentals. Another reason why one has to understand what one is doing. It's fundamental. So over time it's going to have an effect, because the Torah reaches down to the depths of the person's soul, obviously. Hashem created us, obviously. Thus, we hunger for bread. This confirms so many ideas that the Birkat HaMazon is said bread. Bread is Kovei Asuda. Bread is a staple. It's a different impact on the existence of an individual. And here, it doesn't just mandate to eat this food on this night. That's true. That is true. But it's really inaugurating the entire character of the holiday. As Chag HaMatzos says it. And basically, it doesn't command us to eat matzah again, except for a suda. If you want to have a suda, that's true. But there's no specific mitzvah to eat the matzah. But we're forced into it. We have to eat, because you can't eat bread. So it becomes the holiday of matzah. And the effect, you see that it's distinctive. It is distinctive. How is it distinctive? Because a person longs for bread. And he's going to notice that he can't have bread. And he's going to notice the matzah. And that's going to force him to think about it. The nature of a person is that when he has deprivation or whatever the case may be, he's forced to think about it. Why am I in this situation? What's the idea over here? And you see the same thing taking place with regard to Sukkot. Chag HaSukkot, is it the holiday of Sukkot? You're going to notice it. Even though the commandment to eat in the sukkah is only on the first night, but he's got to dwell in the sukkah. So that makes a bigger impact. That's more invasive, I would say. Sukkot is more invasive because it hits a person where he lives. No pun. That's surely the case. It's a major change in lifestyle. Pesach also is a change in lifestyle on a different level. It's hitting a person where he eats. That's very significant. Person notices. And it picks one thing of all things, which makes the biggest impact. Because other than that, you see the bread. If it told you you couldn't have an egg, or you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, I mean, so what? You'd find a substitute. There's nothing that measures. There's nothing that's so significant. But it hits you with leaven. Everything revolves around that. So you got the bread, you got the crackers, you got the cookies. And everything you're eating is a substitute. Doesn't work. Doesn't satisfy that longing. Ah. So then it gets you to thinking. The theme is there. We're all cognizant. The truth is, exactly, most cases, as soon as it's over, people head for the pizza shop. But again, I'm saying there's a difference between that and the morrow. Can somebody explain that to me? The morrow hits you in a more visceral way. Especially, well, there too, there's always room to sort of get around it. You have choice. If you eat the lettuce, it's not that bitter. Again, it could be more abstract. Then it's abstract. But if you eat the horseradish, then, boom, it hits you. Is it better to eat the horseradish, or is it just as good to eat the lettuce? Generally, I do both. Let me suggest that there's the halachic fulfillment. The halacha goes according to its own categories, and that is whatever qualifies as being moral. There's a certain object. So there are types of lettuce whose root may be bitter, and that qualifies. You fulfill the mitzvah with them. And to that extent, it's sort of similar to the matzah, that you know the idea, and then you're eating something which signifies the idea, then you fulfill it. If you eat something that's very, very bitter, it seems to me that in terms of the fulfillment, that kiyum, belev, the fulfillment in the heart, the realization of the bitterness that the Jews went through, would be greater. So that from a halachic standpoint, they're both equal, but from the philosophical standpoint, I think there is a benefit, since the whole objective is to experience this, that it should be real for you, the reality should come through, and to the extent that it's actually bitter, it does have a greater impact. So then I would say from a philosophical standpoint. And since it's a kiyum, since it's a fulfillment, then at some point you can, you know, mix together, whatever the case may be, so that you do partake of that as well. But I'm not saying you have to. According to this, I would say, therefore, that even though he didn't say right that moment before, that's the idea of pointing to it. It's interesting. He says in order to lechabev, it's a very, very important point, to render the object more beloved to you. It's a beautiful idea, because how does it become beloved to you? Through understanding the signification. That's how something becomes significant to you. That is, without that, it's a, you know, it's just an object, it's a ritual, whatever, and you know, you're just doing it. It's perfunctory. It has no meaning. But once it has meaning, that's the idea of chibuv mitzvah. Then you appreciate. Then it becomes something which is appreciated. So you appreciate the matzah. That's the way we should treat mitzvahs. With appreciation. That's a big point. Which generally, on that night, we give praise to Hashem. We give thanks to Hashem. We give praise to Hashem. But the feeling of appreciation is not always there, obviously. Thus, I would say that, if possible, we say this, and then when you're about to eat it, you should think of the ideas. Think of the idea, and then you're fulfilling it properly. It's obvious that it's an enhancement of the mitzvah of the seeper. The question would be, though, why are we saying he didn't fulfill? There's no question that the seeper is enhanced by the object. It's always the case. Let me give an example. You see, the psychology that the Seder is based upon, we can see this all the time. When a person is telling over a story, when he wants to really make an impact, or let's say, for example, the prosecutor in the courtroom, when he wants to convince the jurors that this person did the deed that he's describing. So he can describe it in the abstract, but he'll always seek to have something concrete, like the murder weapon. If he can display the murder weapon, and he's talking about how he took the knife, the kitchen knife, and it was 14 inches, the blade, etc., and he plunged it into our heart, he's going to be very dramatic. Now, is there any need to take a knife and show us? I think we're all capable of imagining what a 14-inch kitchen knife looks like. But if he has the actual knife, he'll show it. And in fact, the lawyer might object that he's emotionally having too much of an emotional effect on the jurors. And they'll be aghast if they see that. And if there's some blood on it, they'll be a big aghast, because it heightens the sense of reality. When you're telling a story and you are backing it up with certain implements, it has an effect upon you. So therefore, that's the psychology. That you tell the story, so you tell about the Exodus. And it was so quick. Okay, you can do so much, you can do very good. But then here's the matzah. It was so quick that they didn't have time for the bread to rise, then you show the matzah. And you explain the mitzvah. The mitzvah itself is testimony. The mitzvah itself is a testimony to the event. As a result of that event, we have the mitzvah. So that is another way of, that has to be incorporated into the telling of the story. The fact that as a result of this event, we have this mitzvah. So it's two things. That's a separate idea. It's the show and tell phenomenon. And it's also the mitzvah phenomenon. That this night left such an impression that we have the mitzvah. That's what it led to. There is a difference between the matzah and the moror in this respect, that by the matzah we're saying this is actual, this is factual. That factually speaking, that's the pasuk you cite. The verse that you cite, which is another important idea, that when you're transmitting something, you should do so in an organized fashion. That look at the organization. A person should be organized when they present an idea. It should start off with a question. You don't just start off with an explanation. Before you give an explanation, you point out what the question is, that there's a problem over here. Get people focused. You have to recognize the question. Be methodical. And then you give the idea. Then you show the verse. How do I know? It's not just my own idea. I'm not just making something up, but I have a source. And the source is in line with the idea. That's the three steps. Question, answer, source. You have the same thing with the moror. This moror, again, you point out the moror that we eat. What is the reason? And the reason is Shemeru HaMitzrim, because the Egyptians embittered the life of our fathers in Egypt. That is, the moror is not an object that's found in the life in their life in Egypt. It doesn't reflect their life in Egypt. That is, that they didn't eat moror in Egypt. Or there was nothing in the course of the Exodus which caused them to eat moror. But rather, because they embittered their lives. In the case of the moror, it reflects an abstract idea that the life was bitter. But there's no particular object that would indicate, well, you have the charoses and stuff like that, but that's a different level, because that's a secondary thing. The mortar, the bricks, that's true, but that's a secondary level. That indirectly reflects the bitterness, but it's not a direct expression. The Torah wanted that idea, the idea of the bitterness. That's a word that is used. Vayemeru eschayim, they embittered their lives. It's a very hard word to even define, although we all have a sense, but we just use it vaguely. I'm very bitter about that. We have a lot of different things. It says that when at the opening phases, when Moshe came to the Jews, and after the setback, the initial setback, and they had to go and collect the straw. So then it says that Moshe came back and they didn't listen to Moshe from shortness of spirit and hard work.
That's different though.
But that itself is not exactly bitterness. A person can work very, very hard, and a person can be exhausted, but that's not necessarily what we would call bitterness. It does go on to list. It's very important. Because when he cites the proof of this, as it says in Shemos, he quotes the source, Vayemaru eschayim, they embittered their lives. Bavoda kasha means with hard work. Bechomer uvelveinim, with bricks and mortar. Uvechol avoda basada, and all types of work in the field. Eis kol avodasam, all of the work that they imposed upon them, the farach, meaning backbreaking labor. It implies a breaking of the spirit. There's different types of enslavements, there's different types of work. For example, you have in the South, when they had slavery, the blacks were slaves. So that's, of course, it's an evil. But there are different cases. Some people were really abused, were treated like animals, but there were cases where the owner was a benevolent owner. It's theoretically possible to have the phenomenon of slavery, but it's not necessarily where the person is destroyed by that. You have a different kind of a concept of avdus. The Torah, Avram Avinu had refers to Eliezer was Eved Avram. It's more of a servant. You can have a slave. It is definitely possible to conceive of the fact that the slave would be treated well, would enjoy his work, and be very happy in the situation. And there were many cases after the Civil War where the slaves were freed and many of them wanted to return. They had a very good situation. Now, I'm not saying that that's obviously the ideal is human freedom, but I'm just trying to point out that their lives were not embittered. Here, there was more. The objective of the enslavement was to break their spirit, was to destroy their spirit, to make them... That's a bitterness. So that wipes the whole existence. The person is just barely alive. It's the destruction of the spirit. A bitter person cannot achieve anything. There's nothing left. Once a person can... People have a tremendous capacity for absorption, for absorbing difficulties in life, and they can adapt. And if there's enough, even if it's tougher than they would like it to be, but people can adapt and they can find meaning and they can still have a certain type of a human existence. But the bitterness indicates that there was a attempt to destroy their spirit. That's the nature of the kind of avdus they endured. To destroy their spirit because of the afflictive nature, the backbreaking, it was without dignity. There's a number of different things that I mentioned. Forcing somebody to do useless activity, backbreaking activity or useless activity, all of these things destroy the spirit of a person. And none of these things, there's no object over here. As there is, but when you talk about the haste of the redemption, the speed of the redemption, you have a, so to speak, I don't like to use the word, you don't have artifact, but you have, so to speak, an artifact, because this actually occurred. They left and they didn't have time for provisions, did not have time for provisions, and they had to bake bake something very quickly. Who goes, lochamech, they didn't have time to leaven. They just put together flour and water and they baked it and that's it. So that's perfect illustration. That's an illustration of the phenomenon which is taken from the actual event. The bitterness of the... That's an abstract idea. There's no particular object that... because it was in many ways, it was a process. It says in the field, working in the field, working with mortar, working with bricks. There's many different ways in which you could demonstrate it, but you can't demonstrate it directly. It's indirect. So, what they did was they had to choose a way in which a person would internalize that idea of the bitterness through eating, because all of the mitzvos, everything is done, all the enactments are through eating. So there was no real particular object like you have by the matzah. So therefore they created the entity, the mitzvah, which was the moror. The bitter herbs. And here too you see the halachic process that the bitter herbs itself, everything operates in accordance with halachic categories. It's not a physical entity. Interestingly enough, it doesn't even have to taste bitter. As we said, it's better because the idea is driven home. But once you have a halachic system, it works with conceptually. It always works with ideas. And they created the idea of moror, that there is such a thing as moror, and that is the best vehicle to reconnect us to the concept that they're trying to, because we do have, interestingly enough, bitter. The word bitter is an interesting term. Vayimeiru moror. We have bitter foods. A person, oh, this tastes bitter. So, to reenact that concept, they The Torah, that day, I mean, the Torah Hashem created the phenomenon of Mara. But it's a halachic phenomenon. Right, we're continuing now with the study of the Haggadah. Yesterday we explained the necessity for the reasons. That is that the activities of the night, the mitzvos of the night, everything is geared towards a certain objective, which is something that is fulfilled in one's consciousness. It's a duty of one's consciousness to be cognizant of what took place and what the significance is. Now, of course, the Jews were redeemed, and they were given, they became the Jewish people. They were given the Torah. They received their identity and their mission. And thus, the obligation, a basic obligation of every Jew, is obviously to fulfill the system, to live according to the Torah, and of course, to transmit the Torah to the next generation. So that's the objective of this evening. And therefore, the performance must be different on this evening. The performance must be with consciousness, with awareness, and with understanding, as opposed to a perfunctory kind of performance, which we said, from a halachic standpoint, there's a halachic system. From a halachic standpoint, if one performs the mitzvah, so one performs the mitzvah. Regardless of how much the person, quote-unquote, gets out of it, in terms of their hashkafa, in terms of their self-elevation. The fact of the matter is they perform the mitzvah. That itself is a significant thing. Every time you perform a mitzvah, you're acknowledging the creator of the universe and revelation and the truth of Torah, the eternity of Torah, and so on. But even that can become perfunctory. There's nothing that can protect us from that. We're humans, and the most exalted deed can become perfunctory. It's a funny, just another thought on the difference between the matzah and the moror, in that the fulfillment of the matzah, the purpose of the matzah, is not dependent upon the taste, the impression that it makes upon your senses. It's a conceptualization. It's the awareness of matzah and what it stands for. While the same is true with regard to moror, that is, one associates this activity with the bitterness experience of Egypt, here the association is not purely in the abstract, but it's through the sensory. It's making an impression. You're supposed to feel the bitterness. There's nothing in the matzah that you feel the quickness or anything like that, other than, the only thing I'd say about the matzah is the fact that the matzah is different than ordinary bread. So that one notices. But it's not, that's just to signify that it's different than ordinary bread. And then you ask yourself, well, why am I eating this? Why am I not biting into a roll or something like that? And then you make the mental association. And the next issue we turn to is the Halach Ma'anya, which is at the outset. That's the beginning of the Haggadah, which, interestingly enough, this paragraph is not part of the actual original Haggadah, this Halach Ma'anya, the bread of affliction. But this was ordained in Babylon, which of course explains, I mean, if we take a look at this, the thing that's glaring is that it's written in Aramaic, and the rest of the Haggadah is in Hebrew. If you take a closer look at it, you'll notice that there is some Hebrew in it. The last sentence, which says, now we are here, this sentence itself is broken up into Aramaic and in Hebrew. Because it starts off by saying, Hashata Avde, now we are slaves. That's Aramaic. The Shana Haba'a B'nei Chorin, that is Hebrew. Next year, may we be free. So, why is this entire paragraph in Aramaic, and why is the last sentence divided between Hebrew and Aramaic? But, of course, what's the idea of the entire paragraph. It starts off by explaining the lachma anya, the either poor person's bread or bread of affliction, which pretty much means this is the bread that poor people or slaves eat, which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. The question is that it seems that it's both a quote-unquote symbol, a reflection of the slavery, and also the geula. That would seem to be a bit unusual. How could that be? That's the very same thing is a symbol of two opposites. I'm just noticing that one of the commentators, the Avudraham, explains the meaning that our fathers ate in Egypt that this is he quotes an interpretation in the name of the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra was apparently was captured and was a prisoner in Hodu. Hodu is India. At one point, I don't know what the story is, but anyways, and they would feed him matzah, and they never gave him chametz. And the reason is because it's hard, and it doesn't get digested that quickly, like chametz. And therefore, a smaller amount suffices. And that's what the Egyptians did to the Jews in Israel. In other words, they fed them matzah. So that's why it would be a bread of affliction. Well, basically that's the idea. A prisoner doesn't eat the best bread, obviously. So even I don't know about how it is today in America. It's a different world here, and prisoners' rights and all that. But if you go back to the older days when they weren't constrained by these things, prisoners were treated much, much more harshly. Nobody really cared. So the kind of bread they would get would be a hard piece of bread, you know, minimalistic type of thing. Maybe it wasn't matzah, but same idea. I'm thinking of another thought that the essence of the redemption, the essence of the transformation, is really not dependent upon any externals. The essence is really the redemption of the soul and the recognition of Hashem, the renunciation of idolatry, the recognition of Hashem, that's the essence of the redemption. So the very same food, it doesn't make any difference. The true freedom of the person doesn't have to do with the externals. So there's no contradiction between using the same object. Person can be in the same situation, the same house, the same physical situation, and feel downtrodden, feel oppressed, feel that the person doesn't have what they need, or poor or inferior. Then, if there's an internal change, they discover a purpose in life. They discover Hashem. There's a transformation. So now they can it's a totally different thing. They're not the same people anymore. There's clearly an association between the two. The redemption, which is the matzah, the speed, the haste, is always to be associated with the enslavement. Actually, that's really the beginning. The beginning of the redemption was the enslavement. That's the bris bein hapsarim. That they'll be strangers in a different land, and not just that they'll be strangers, but that they'll be afflicted, they'll be enslaved, and that's an essential phenomenon. That they have to go through the transformation. They have to go through that experience. The experience is essential. So the experience of the enslavement with everything that it entailed, the bitterness and the deprivation, the fact that they were forced to eat the bread of the poor, the humbling phenomenon, everything that they went through was for a purpose. It wasn't that they should suffer per se, but there's a benefit in that they went through a transformation. And once they went through the transformation, so then it eventuated, it led to the Geula, to the redemption. So that's, went from a transformation into being ordinary people. They were subjected to the natural order. They went through a period of tremendous growth, and they assumed the status of being a people, a nation. But it was without Torah, without mitzvos. The transformation was to render them into a unique people, which would accept the Torah. That was the whole purpose. That's what the rabbis say, that God offered the Torah to the other nations and they rejected it. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, whatever. Thou shalt not commit adultery. They viewed the Torah as taking away their freedom, their instinctual freedom. And the way people are constructed, people are not going to accept the Torah. Because the way they view it as an enslavement, interestingly enough, as an imposition on their freedom. That's why, even as we said, the other religions that claim to be based, go back, trace themselves back to the quote-unquote Old Testament, but they revise it. They don't keep the mitzvahs. They negate, that's the first thing they do, is to negate the commandments. Because they view that as being in conflict with their freedom. So, the Jews too. The Jews would also have rejected, apparently, would have rejected the Torah. Because the natural inclination is to pursue your own goals, the pursuit of happiness. And once the Jews developed, and the Torah describes it, how they went through an amazing period of growth and development and strength, so then you want to assert yourself. There's a certain feeling of self-determination, there's a feeling of nationalism, so you grab. You try to achieve whatever you have the ability to achieve, but you're not going to accept the Torah. At the outset, you're going to view that as a, well, first of all, it's going to be a renunciation of your identity. Now you're going to be servants of God instead of your own nation. So that's what the enslavement. The enslavement meant they lost complete freedom. And they turned to Hashem. Because they lost complete freedom in terms of the ordinary desires, so they were pretty much forced into a different realm. That is that they could achieve their freedom, but a different kind of freedom. This is something that, in that sense, had to be imposed on them. That's the idea of the Gemara, that God threatened them, I'll turn the mountain over you. And then later on, in Purim, they accepted it out of love. That's the idea of the Torah, that at the outset, it's impossible to accept the Torah out of love. Because it's contrary to the person's natural desires for self-expression. However, if a person, due to circumstances, is, so to speak, coerced into keeping the Torah, so then he's going to be keeping it. And he's going to be studying it. Then he will learn to love it. Because it's something which you have to cultivate a taste for. There's no natural desire for Torah. You have to cultivate a taste for it. So therefore, a person has to be forced to cultivate the taste. Once he does that, then he realizes that this was a treasure. That's what we say before the shofar, that I rejoice over your word as one who finds great treasure. But it's a reflection of that idea. That's the Rambam in his introduction to Chelek. How you raise a child. You have to work with the lo lishma. You have to work with the ulterior motive. Because it's impossible to communicate to a child that the reason to study Torah is because this is more fun than anything else. It's just an impossibility. And the child over here is not necessarily a little child. To tell this to adults. Adults are the same thing. How are you going to convince a person that enjoying Torah is greater than going to a show on Saturday night? They'll laugh at you. They will respect Torah. There's a place for it, and that's a serious thing, and we should do it. But they don't put that in the same compartment as going out and having fun. The moral is to acknowledge the bitterness. On a simple level, that's part of the idea that the praise of Hashem is contingent. The appreciation is contingent upon an awareness of the bitterness, of the extent of the suffering. And that it was only because of Hashem that we got out of that, that we could have been removed from that. The Rambam in the Mora, in the paperback, page 353, he's talking about the reasons for the holidays. So, Passover and Sukkos. He says that the Feast of Sukkos reminds us of the miracles wrought in the wilderness. The moral lessons derived from these feasts. These feasts, meaning Sukkot and Passover, is this. Man ought to remember his evil days and his days of prosperity. He will thereby be induced to thank God repeatedly to lead a modest and humble life. We therefore eat unleavened bread and bitter herbs on Passover in memory of what happened unto us, and leave our houses on Sukkot in order to dwell in booths as inhabitants of deserts do that are in want of comfort. We shall thereby remember that this has once been our condition. Quote, I made the Jews of Israel to dwell in booths. Although we now dwell in elegant houses, in the best and most fertile land, and by the kindness of God, and because of his promises to our forefathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who were perfect in their opinions and in their conduct. This idea is likewise an important element in our religion, that whatever good we have received and ever will receive of God is owing to the merits of the patriarchs, who kept the way, quote, kept the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment. This is a very, very important principle. Now the Rambam over here, when he associates these mitzvos with this point, to remember the evil days and the days of comfort, when we're in a state of comfort, not to forget, to remember, he says that's why we eat bitter herbs and matzah. So the matzah that he's referring to over here is the matzah of affliction, so to speak, not the matzah of redemption. Clearly then, according to the Rambam, the matzah has the signification of the enslavement as well. And that's a major purpose. That is, on this night, we have to, that's one of the objectives, that it's not enough to just celebrate you cannot celebrate the redemption just to focus on the redemption. Theoretically, conceptually, you possibly could. This is the day that we were redeemed and just have a holiday. Why do we have to go into all of the bad times? That might be an impulse of many people who achieve something, some kind of independence. Interestingly enough, you'll soon see, after Pesach, they're going to have Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day. And how do people celebrate that? They'll just celebrate the independence. I don't know if people hearken back to the days when they didn't have the freedom, the struggles that they went through. They're not going to do that. They're just going to celebrate the joy of being independent, whatever that is. I don't know how much significance it has. It does not have any significance. That's an interesting phenomenon. You will see that people will observe Yom HaAtzmaut. I don't think it has any kind of spiritual significance. It's just an opportunity to have a celebration or whatever the case may be. Part of the problem is because it's not accompanied by any sense of appreciation. When people lose their sense of appreciation, what I'm talking about is a secular phenomenon.
Ben.
I'm not talking about religious Zionists and how they choose to observe it. I'm just talking about Israelis who are Israelis in a nationalistic kind of sense, how they perceive it. You have the same thing in America. It becomes pretty meaningless. July 4th and so on and so forth, American Independence Day. It becomes meaningless because nobody appreciates it. The reason nobody appreciates it is because they're not humble and because they take it for granted. It's something that you were born with. So you feel superior. And the original generation of Israelis, those who established and fought for it, they rejoiced, they were patriotic, they had a tremendous love because they didn't have it. They didn't take it for granted. That was something that was an achievement. So as long as the idea of an achievement exists, so then there's a certain rejoicing. But that's going to fade away. It's just a natural process. I'm not criticizing anybody. That's just a natural phenomenon. You see that in immigrants. They come to America. They struggle. They work and have a very difficult life, but they're doing it all for the children. And the children, it depends. I mean, sometimes it's the second generation. By the third generation, when the wealth is created and everybody's got it easy, so to speak, the grandparents who went through it, and maybe the parents a little bit, they have an appreciation. America has a significance for them. But there's an irony over there. It's an intrinsic irony. You struggle and build up something, you have a more difficult, so you want it easier for your children. And then what happens, so parents do all these things for their children that they should not have to go through it. I went through, I worked hard, I had to have an extra job as a waiter and I would day, and all the hardships. And there's an irony in that they provide all these things for their children, and then they're upset that the children don't seem to appreciate it. But that's the reality. You, in a sense, deprived your children from the capability of appreciating it by making it all available to them like nothing. So there's taking it for granted. That was your idea. Right. Your idea was that they shouldn't have to suffer. So if you don't want them to suffer, fine. They're gonna grow up with a completely different attitude towards these things than you had. They're not going to appreciate it because they always had it. They never were deprived, and they didn't have to work for it. So you see that an important aspect of the Seder is to deal with that problem, to reestablish the idea of the bitterness, that you should relate to that, and you shouldn't take it for granted, and you should have a sense of humbleness. If a person believes that he has something because it's coming to him by nature, so then he cannot be humble and he can't appreciate it. That's what the Rambam is saying over here. That two ideas over here are intended to instill humbleness and gratitude. One is that this was your state. You were in a very lowly state. That already takes away the idea of entitlement. You're nothing special. There's no reason why you have to be in this exalted state. This was your state. The state of humbleness. You're a slave. That's the lowest. And therefore, whatever you have is because of redemption. Because there's a supreme being who took you out of it. But other than that, you'd still be a slave. Lest you think that, well, that means I'm important. Because the supreme being intervened and removed me, then you got the other side. That's what the Rama mentions. That it's only because of the avos. It's a fundamental of the Torah that all the good things that come to us is not because of our merit, but only because of what we call schus avos, the merit of the fathers. This is part of the idea of maschol bignus umasayim b'shevach, that we start the story with the degradation, which is on two different levels. Mm-hmm. The gnus, the degradation, is the physical degradation, the state that we were in, and of course, in a more abstract way, the real degradation is the part that we say later on, that from the outset our forefathers were idol worshippers, which is a worse degradation. And now God has brought us close to His service. It's interesting that the matzah, as a sign or a symbol of the enslavement, is not the matzah that's eaten. Matzah is serving two roles at the Seder. It's there as, so to speak, quote-unquote, a prop, that the recitation we recited in conjunction with the matzah. That's playing the role of demonstration. The matzah that we eat is the matzah of redemption. That's what, why we say. This matzah that we eat, why do we eat it? Because of the hastiness of the redemption. So that is, in terms of the mitzvah of matzah, we don't eat, we don't have in mind we're eating the matzah because this was the bread of affliction. We eat it because it was the sign of the redemption. That's the impact. It's interesting, perhaps this gives us some insight, that the real way to eat the matzah, we don't do it the real way, so to speak, because we don't have the Korban Pesach and the Passover sacrifice. When we have the Passover sacrifice, it's eaten in conjunction with matzah and maror. That's what the Torah says, al matzos u'mororim yochlu, that the Passover sacrifice should be eaten with matzah and maror. Thus, the biblical command of maror is only when you have the Passover sacrifice, because it's not an independent phenomenon. Perhaps we can understand it better now with the, on the basis of what the Rambam wrote in the Mora. It's not an independent phenomenon. It's an accident of the Passover sacrifice. And one would have thought the same about matzah. The Gemara has that discussion, since it also says that it should be eaten with matzah. So therefore the matzah is an accident of the Passover sacrifice. So why do we eat matzah today? Because there's a separate verse, Be'erev tochlu matzos, in the evening you shall eat matzos, which means to say that matzah assumes its own signification. So it has two, it exists in two ways. A, matzah is connected to the mitzvah of the Passover sacrifice, just like maror. But B, it also has an independent existence. It's a mitzvah in its own right. So today, maror is rabbinic. Maror that we eat today is rabbinic. The joining of the maror is the bitterness, together with the matzah and the Pesach. The Korban Pesach is really the redemption. That is, that the Jews renounced idolatry, and they brought the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice, was part and parcel of the redemption. The sprinkling of the blood, the skipping over the houses, the destruction of the firstborn, that was the destruction of the Egyptians. So I can understand. That's in line with the Rambam's idea. Today, the matzah is the matzah of redemption. So the eating of the maror is for this idea that the Rambam is talking about, that we should remember that we can't just focus on the redemption, that you have to remember the bitterness. At the time that you're experiencing the redemption, you have to experience the bitterness to remember Bedafka then, specifically then, to remember the bitterness and how bad the situation was. It's interesting. The characteristic of the matzah as an object is the bread of affliction. But it's not called the bread of redemption. It's not the bread of redemption. It's the bread of affliction. But the purpose of eating it is to experience the redemption. To experience the redemption. The theme in the redemption is the haste. So the fact that you make it very quickly, That's what it's seized upon. In terms of the being a sign and a symbol of redemption, it's because of the haste, that they didn't have time. So they had to make, they had to bake the butzek quickly. They couldn't let it rise. There was no time to let it rise. Correct? What I'm saying is that it's multi-determined. The selection of matzah as the mitzvah is multi-determined. It has this characteristic that it demonstrates the haste of the redemption. So that's fine. That's in that sense. But it's multi-determined because it's connected to other aspects of the experience. That is, this very same food with which they experienced the enslavement, so that enslavement was part of this whole process, which was transformed. The entire process was transformed into a freedom experience, into a redemption experience. So that is the character of the matzah. The character of the matzah is that it's the bread of affliction. And the purpose of eating the matzah is because that at the moment of redemption, they also needed matzah. They didn't have time for bread either. So that's the perfect object, the perfect symbol, so to speak. And it fulfills what the Rambam said, that the necessity of understanding that aspect of it, the aspect of degradation. So that's why it starts off with Holach Ma'anya. Because all along, they couldn't get regular bread because of the enslaved. It shows their degraded status. The matzah reflects the degraded status. Lechemoni. However, when they were redeemed from Egypt, that wasn't the reason. The reason for the matzah was a different reason now. Was not because that they were slaves. To the contrary, it's because they were being redeemed and they were pushed out in a hurry. The speed of the redemption. So that's the idea. That's the paragraph. This is the bread of affliction, and the fact that it's in Aramaic, it's been inserted. It was inserted at a later date. It's not part of the original Haggadah. What issue is it addressing? Why is it there? There's a big problem in the whole idea of having a Seder. And so to speak, there's like an elephant in the room that we all have to pretend that we don't see. What's the elephant in the room? Gullus. That is, one could ask a question, because we're talking about, we're not celebrating a historical phenomenon. It's an ongoing phenomenon. That God redeemed us, we say in the Ma'ariv, L'cheiras Olam, eternal freedom. And we're going to be saying that we view it as though we left Egypt, and not just our fathers did God redeem, but God redeemed us. So the whole theme is not just that this happened in the past, but we have to view it as though this happened to us. This is our experience. And as a result of this experience, we attain our freedom. Well, if that's the case, so what do we... It wasn't the purpose to bring us, to give us the Torah, and to bring us to the land, and to live in that land as a free people. So what happened? How come we're in exile? This is a different type of a Seder. And this issue has to be addressed. That is that if we're eternally free, so what are we doing in Chutz La'aretz? What are we doing outside of the land of Egypt? I believe that's why we say, even in Aramaic, that it's stated in Aramaic, because everything that we do on this night, we're demonstrating something. Well, the way we tell the story is not just with words, but it should... You're acting it out. So therefore, this is something that we take for granted. We don't notice this. We don't focus on this. What is the most blatant expression of exile? We have to acknowledge the fact that we're not in the ideal state that we're supposed to be in. We're in a state of exile. And that can't be eliminated. We don't pretend that it's not the case. So we start off at the very outset. You must acknowledge that. Because every generation must strive for the redemption. Even though there was an original redemption, but that's redemption one. There's the ultimate redemption. So we can't pretend that we're there. Now, what is the most blatant sign of exile? We take this for granted. We don't speak the language that was supposed to. We don't even speak our language, which is Hebrew. We don't even notice that that's a problem. We're speaking a foreign language. Lashon HaKodesh is very significant. And that's what the Jews are supposed to speak. And we don't speak a lot. Today there's some that do, some don't, but people, that's a question of can you speak. People that have been in Israel for a while, maybe they can communicate. But when you're the majority of American Jews do not speak Hebrew, can't speak Hebrew. I don't even know if they know Hebrew. And even if they can, they don't use the language. So Aramaic is the quintessential language of Golos, because that was the first Golos, and that was the major, that really is the symbol of Golos, is Bavel. So how can we be celebrating freedom when we're in exile? The significance of the exile can't be overlooked. Imagine if you had somebody visiting you, let's say a non-Jew, or whether a Jew or a non-Jew, even a person that's not familiar, doesn't understand all the ideas of the Torah, they would ask this question. What do you mean you're free? What kind of freedom is it? Maybe you were free then, but you lost it. There are many people, instances of, throughout history of people, nations that were liberated and developed a culture and an empire, and then they disappeared or they lost their freedom. So what are we saying over here? The significance of exile is it's a major thing. I mean, it's, for example, Christianity used it against us for a few thousand years. It's just until recently that they've gone back on that idea, but that the Jews were replaced, the Jews were rejected, and the proof of it is that you're in exile. Why did God toss you out of the land? Because he rejected you. So it's not a simple thing to be in exile. Not even to have your own land, and you're proclaiming your freedom here. And it's a beautiful idea. I think it's proclaiming the idea that the Jewish people is a completely different phenomenon. It's a metaphysical type of a nation. It's a different entity. It exists above and beyond land, boundaries, land, etc. And it has two forms of existence. The phenomenon of exile does not contradict the concept of the Jewish people. Fundamental to the idea of the formation of the Jewish people is that we are in a special relationship with Hashem. That relationship with Hashem is expressed by blessings and curses, positive or negative. There's no neutral position. The Jews are a different kind of a nation. Whose fate is not determined by the ordinary circumstances that would determine the fate of other nations. Which is, for example, if a nation acts with wisdom, with intelligence, with strength, it'll be successful. If it abandons that course, becomes decadent and lazy and weak and makes stupid political decisions, it'll suffer the consequences. That is to say, it's a product of the natural order. But the idea of the bris, of the covenant, means that the Jews, their fate is determined by a different system. It has to do with their behavior. The behavior on two levels. Primarily the behavior on the religious level, but that is not so simplistic as we've seen. It doesn't just mean perfunctory observance. It means to achieve a certain degree of perfection in terms of living according to the ideas of Torah, the Derech HaChaim, the way of life of Torah. And, of course, part of that Derech HaChaim means that we don't rely, we don't just sit back and pray. That Derech HaChaim demands that we engage in the natural order, in accordance with anything we can do. Whatever you have, Obviously, a person is not permitted to just pray, as long as there's something that they can do. And they're not permitted to just engage the natural order and forget about prayer. You got to do both. But the idea of the covenant of the bris is that our experience, our fate, our destiny is not just based upon our interaction with the natural order. There's a metaphysical dimension, and that can't be escaped. That can express itself only either for good, obviously, that's the hope, that's the blessings, that if it'll be, that's what we say first. That if we follow the Torah, if we love Hashem, if we live this kind of life, then Hashem will provide us with tremendous, tremendous bounty. So it'll be visible to the entire world. What's interesting is that if we reject the Torah, Hishamar Lachem, we read that, if you turn away from the Torah and you worship other gods, whatever they are, that is, you live according to other ideals and other principles, then even if you act in an intelligent way, this is very, very crucial, even if you act in a politically intelligent and a rational way, such that if it were a different nation, it would lead to success because that's the correct way to go, you will fail. You will fail because the metaphysical dimension will see to it that that's the curse. The curse is that you don't have that option anymore. Once you enter into the bris, you don't have the option of, so to speak, neutrality. That is, you decide, well, we'll take our chances. We'll go on our own. Cannot be. We can't exist as an ordinary entity, which is based purely on political and military and other factors. Now, that is something which the world doesn't recognize. That is to say that the providence of Hashem is there in the positive, but also in the negative. That the Jews, the experience, the historical experience of the Jews is going to be different than any other nation. For good or for bad. But people don't want to see that even something like the Holocaust is a manifestation of providence. This doesn't happen to nations, this type of thing. Especially after they've been in a country for 1,000 years and all the contributions they made and the integration they've achieved and the rights they've achieved, and suddenly a new regime comes up and turns against them and subjects them to the worst destruction ever. Now, people don't want to face that because it's too painful a topic. And by the way, nobody can really understand this point. A huge mistake that people make is with their entire, since they have a false idea of providence, a lot of times people will say, well, what's the point? There's a Holocaust, so what good is the whole system? They can't see that that itself is also providence. They can't see that. Because they have a false idea of providence. For them, providence means to just give out all the goodies, the good things, and just to be there to enable you to live whatever life you want to live. That's the way they look at it. That's why they have all these questions of tsunami and earthquakes. Why didn't God save these people? Without asking as to what kind of life these people are living, is that kind of life worthy of divine intervention, and so on. Those types of questions. Because people have no clue at all as to what the idea of providence is. And the conditions, the situations, which would determine when it's manifested. So that's what this paragraph is teaching us. The paragraph is teaching us that this is a different kind of phenomenon. And that it's a nation that can exist in exile. It exists in two different states. But the fact that it's in exile is not a rejection of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people can reach great heights in exile. So that's the idea. L'shana hashata hacha, l'shana ba b'yared Yisrael. Is that even though we're in exile, the Jewish people is still a Jewish people. That's the essence. And that has to do with the fact that there's an Am. Kol dechvin yeseh v'yechol. It's the way we live our life. The way we live our life, and that even in exile, the essence of the Jewish people is not that we have to have a land. That's a bracha. That enables us to achieve a certain state of existence. But the essence is expressed by the fact that we keep the mitzvahs. The attachment to the mitzvahs, the fact that God set up a system in which we have the mitzvahs, and there's an eternal connection between the Jews and the mitzvahs, which will never be broken. That's the way God arranged it, is such that since the essence of the nation is not dependent on a physical, on an external, but the essence has to do with its connection to the system of mitzvahs, that's why it's an eternal nation. So even though externally it can be having very difficult circumstances, and it's not, the freedom is not a visible freedom, but that doesn't matter. The essence of the Jewish people is its connection to the mitzvahs, the relationship of Jew to Jew, called Dechvin Yesei V'Yechol, that's Chesed. These are the elements. Mitzvos, Kol Dechvin is Chesed. Kol Ditzrich Yezei V'Yivsach means whoever has a need to celebrate the Pesach. That's Kol Yisrael HaRevenzev in the realm of Mitzvos. That's not just an ordinary type of brotherhood, but it means the responsibility that one Jew has for a fellow Jew in terms of assisting him, enabling him to keep the Mitzvos. So that means that the Jewish people remains intact, and they're always, always looking forward to the redemption. That idea that they have a consciousness of being the Jewish people, because they're always eternally connected to the mitzvos, and they're always looking forward to redemption, that's Lashon HaBa B'Yahr the Yisrael. That's what keeps the Jewish people going. So that even in Golos, we give Shevach for the redemption, because the system is an eternal system. The system is eternal. At any given moment, the particular Jews or a group of Jews, they can lose it. They can become enslaved. There's no guarantee that a particular Jew or a group of Jews at a particular point in time will become enslaved, like the Jews in America today. Those who've turned their back on Torah, and they've simply assimilated, and they've tossed in their fate with American culture. So they're not free. That's a slavish existence. But the Jewish people, the Jewish nation in the abstract, is an eternal entity. When God redeemed us, He redeemed us eternally. Because He created something which will be perpetuated. It's always there. And that's why the last pasuk is Hashata Abde. There's the recognition that by virtue, merely by being in the state of exile, that itself is abdus. We have to be aware of that. You can't say that God took us out and transformed us into free people. It didn't work that way. It can't work that way. Because the freedom has to be within the framework of bechira, of free will. So God does not automatically transform us. That's a mistake. The idea of freedom is that He brought us close. He drew us close to His service. But He didn't do it in a way that we're automatically free. Because to do so would mean that there's no free will. So because of that, there's a phenomenon of exile in Avde, Hashata Avde. Now we are slaves. That is, a person has to recognize that by virtue of being in the exile, that itself is a form of enslavement. It's a mental enslavement, even in America, where you have tremendous freedom. To the contrary, the spiritual enslavement becomes greater because of the misuse of the freedom and the assimilation. So this paragraph is, you see, you don't just say the ideas, but you even say it in Aramaic. You say it in the language of exile. English wouldn't be the language of exile for us because we it's too natural, but in Aramaic we recognize as the language of exile. But the last pasuk, you see this idea that you don't just say these things, but you have to mean them, that it's a reality for you. The idea of Lashana Haba, next year B'nai Chorin, that switches to Hebrew. I don't think that one sentence itself, which starts off with Hashata Avde, and there's a connection, precisely because we recognize that. Precisely because we recognize that, and we reject that, because we recognize the Geula, that it's the will of Hashem that we should be redeemed, and that was the plan, and that's why He took us out of Egypt, and He gave us the Torah, but we failed. we rejected the Torah at a certain point in a serious enough fashion that we were exiled. So precisely because we recognize that this is avdus, that this is enslavement, so Lashon Haba, then we switch to Hebrew. That we continue to strive to achieve that ultimate state. That will never depart. That the Jewish people is an eternal people, and that they'll always be connected to mitzvos, and to the relation of one Jew to another, that we have a special relationship. It's not just an abstract system, but it's a family, so to speak. And that we are absolutely confident that this is temporary, and that the Geula is around the corner. That those are the elements. So it's in that framework that we can then proceed to say the Haggadah, because there's a Haggadah which is said from the standpoint of being B'nai Chorin, of being really, really free in the land of Israel and with the Karban Pesach. And there's another one, another Seder, which is a Seder from the standpoint of people who are in exile, who've lost the opportunity. Where's the Karban Pesach? Karban Pesach he's supposed to bring. Can't bring the Karban Pesach. But we can eat the matzah, because we have the halachic system. So the halachic system makes it eternal.